This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 7th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 412. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature, the 45th anniversary Terry Fox run is September 14th. Canadians will walk, run, or roll to raise money to help end cancer. Hear my interview from 2023 with the late Bill Viggers, the campaign manager for Terry Fox's 1980 Marathon of Hope and author of Terry and Me, the inside story of Terry Fox's Marathon of Hope. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
There are 25 million people who live in Canada. Don't tell me that we can't raise $25 million from the public of Canada. Don't tell me that. See, I gotta set my goals high. Because I believe in miracles, and I have to. Thank you.
Sunday, September 14th, the 45th annual Terry Fox Run in communities big and small. Go to terryfox.org to find out where you can run, walk, or roll to raise money to end cancer in memory of Terry Fox. 2 years ago, in September 2023, I welcomed the late Bill Viggers to the podcast. Back in 1980, Viggers was dispatched by his boss at the Canadian Cancer Society to join Terry's team in progress on the Marathon of Hope in New Brunswick. Bill did not know it at the time, but he had joined the most important road trip in Canadian history. In 2023, Bill's book, Terry and Me, The Inside Story of Terry Fox's Marathon of Hope, had just been published by Sutherland House. Viggers died in October 2024 in White Rock, BC at age 78. Here are highlights of my interview with Bill Viggers. Bill was there, right there in the van, on the road during that summer of 1980, the Summer of Hope, as he calls it. Now, you were working for the Canadian Cancer Society in Ontario when you met Terry. You became the wingman or the wagon master. You weren't there at the very start. April 12, 1980, there was the Outer Cove Beach in Newfoundland where two bottles of Atlantic Ocean water were collected. But you joined up a few months later, June 9th, 1980, in New Brunswick. Recall that first day of your first day on the Marathon of Hope with Terry.
Bob, I had flown overnight from Toronto. I knew very little about Terry. I had spoken to him on the phone several times, and those were the days. There was no cell phone. There was no internet. So he would go to a payphone and call me, collect. And the Cancer Society sent me down to find out, is this guy for real? And the other thing is he had been passing up on his medical checkups. So the other reason they sent me down was to lay down the law, which you'll find out in the book, I chose not to. I got there at 4, but I got there actually about 2:30 in the morning. I knew the guys were going to be up at 4, so I just climbed in the back of my car, covered myself with a piece of plastic from a suit coat. And 4 o'clock in the morning, the lights come on, the door is open, out steps Doug and Daryl and Terry's brother and Terry. And Doug was the first one. He looked at me and as I'm playing out of the backseat of the car, and they were used to dealing, I was 33 at the time, and they were used to dealing with older gentlemen, long coats and fedoras and suits and ties, and there I am in my jeans and t-shirt, and Doug looks at me and said, "You're the guy from the Cancer Society?" And I said, "Well, I hope I'm not a disappointment." And that's how it started. And we had a short visit, and then we jumped in the van. I left the car at the motel, and I drove with him in the dark out the Trans-Canada Highway. And the Trans-Canada Highway at that part, I don't know what it's like now, but it was a two-lane highway and hardly any traffic on the road at that time of the day, just the odd transport truck going by. And every time it went by, as we parked on the side of the road, Terry was getting out, the first truck goes by and it completely shakes the van. And I can remember that morning for the first 4 or 5 hours, basically that's all that's on the road is transport trucks. And every time they go whizzing by, shake the van, and I'm worried about Terry because he's running in the darkness. And we let him out. He gets out, steps on something that's been buried in the ground, and it was a white plastic bag. And every day, Doug had to pull up exactly to that spot so Terry could open the door, put his foot on it to say that he did not take one shortcut. When we were in an urban area, he would use a telephone pole or a fire hydrant and do exactly the same thing, go over and touch it to start the morning and then continue on from there. My first 2 or 3 hours were just sat in amazement, first in the darkness. I can remember, there are so many things of the run burnt in my mind, but that morning, looking in the rearview mirror as he's running towards the van, and you can't see anything until a vehicle comes and lights him up from behind. So I'm watching this silhouette come towards me, and he just floats past the van, doesn't stop. And we pull ahead to another mile because Doug would mark each mile. And Daryl got out with the jug of water and a glass of water. And Terry come up, had a glass of water. Nobody said anything. It's too damn early in the morning, for one thing. And off he goes. And I was in absolute awe from the very first moment I watched him run. And I think everybody was. Anybody that saw him run by in person, where maybe standing that morning at the end of a concession road or on University Ave in Toronto, doesn't matter where you were, and you saw Terry run by, it was a moment of several feelings. There's a story about in the book about a man and a woman standing, and they both went on to become Terry Fox run organizers. And as Terry ran past them that day, and that was in London, he writes about how he noticed that as he ran by, he had a big smile on his face. The guys and the woman was sobbing and crying. And he realized at that moment that Terry brought out different emotions in people. She saw the pain and the effort that he was putting in. He did too, but what he saw was hope and goodness in the world. And I think that's one of the things that Terry brought that people don't realize and talk about that I experienced that summer.
But to run a marathon every day as he did, what was his breakfast? I mean, he talks about him having a glass of water, but what did he have for breakfast? What did he do to fuel himself up?
Breakfast and dinner in particularly. Lunch was usually a clubhouse sandwich and fries and a milkshake and maybe a hamburger. But breakfast was, we used to joke, Terry would order everything on the left side of the menu, and his buddy Doug would never order because he eat whatever Terry didn't finish, which wasn't very much. So he'd have bacon and eggs, pancakes, toast, a hamburger, a milkshake, a pop, a piece of pie. It took a lot to keep the engine burning. And dinner was basically the same thing, but even more. And there was a lot of carbs, a lot of spaghetti. You know, he ate a ton of food, and we made fun of him about it. And it was an ongoing joke with us about how much food he would eat. And people would sit in the restaurant. I remember one time he ordered food in a restaurant, and the waitress turned around and walked away thinking he was ordering food for the entire table. And it was just what he was ordering. So he was a man of good humor. And I think that's another thing people are going to read in this book is what a wonderful sense of humor he had, that he was just a regular guy. And that's what I tried to portray in the book.
And then there was the van, the Ford Econoline van, which also became a symbol. What was it like to be in that van throughout that summer?
That was Terry's refuge. Very few people got in it or rode in it. I would say a handful, maybe 5 or 6 people through the entire run. It smelled horrible, by the way. You have to realize before he gets to Ontario, and then even then, there's 3 guys sleeping in it. It's full of their dirty clothes, the sweat from both of them running, all of them are running. And the facilities, if you want to call them that, were nothing more than a tiny little space by the back door with a bench with a hole cut in it and a plastic bowl. And there was the running competition between whose turn was it to dump it, Daryl or Doug's. And again, much humor surrounded that. People didn't want to. It was interesting. People would walk up to it, and they, as soon as they stuck their head into it, they'd kind of pull back. And as we got into southern Ontario that summer, it was an incredibly hot, humid summer. So all of us, you got to remember, there's four guys running. We're running along collecting money, and the kids. My kids were 8 and 9 at the time, and they were with us for much of the run. Well, you change your shirt. We had boxes and boxes of the Terry Fox shirts. And you probably, you know, changed your shirt 3 or 4 times, all of us 3 or 4 times a day, and you just threw it into the van. And it could be a week before anybody came by to offer to do our laundry. So it was a refuge for Terry. He loved it. Every morning he almost cocooned himself in a sleeping bag as he was driving out to the run. Terry didn't jump out of bed every morning going, wow, I want to go and run a marathon. It was hard for him. It was hard to get up. And then a couple of times during the run, people booked him at more than one event, which means he didn't get supper and he didn't get his right sleep, which led him to be irritable. By the way, the first movie, which was the one that had Robert Duvall in it, portrayed Terry as this angry young man, angry at having cancer. That was so far from the truth, a completely inaccurate portrayal of him. He wasn't angry. He'd get angry at us. And that was usually over him coming. He's running a marathon a day, and he runs up to the van, and we're supposed to have water and oranges ready for him. And we're in the middle of a water fight, throwing buckets of water at each other. And of course, he'd come up and yell at us, you know, you guys only got one job. And there's a wonderful scene in the movie where you don't see the argument, but you do see Daryl pouring him glasses of water. And if you knew what was going on, just 30 seconds before you're watching that, he was yelling at us. Well, 30 seconds later, he's filling his glass up with water, and I'm off screen. And next time you watch the documentary, the scenes in every documentary, Terry takes a sip and for some reason just seems to throw it away. Well, what he's doing is he's trying to hit me with the water just off screen, at which he was being successful, which I let him do because it made him laugh. And it was difficult for him to run, but at the same time, there was much levity on many days. Not all days. Some were a grind.
Now, to get through the grind, he developed his own milestones, basically to keep his mind fresh and to keep going, to endure. And one of them was basically running from telephone pole to telephone pole, that he wasn't thinking of the full distance across the country. It was get to the telephone pole, the next telephone pole, the next one, the next one, the next one.
That's exactly. People would ask him, you know, how do you run a marathon every day? He said just exactly what you said. I don't. I run to that pole, and then I run to the next pole. And there was another thing, even stronger, that kept him going. And he said it on more than one occasion. People would say, doesn't it hurt? Aren't you in pain when you're doing that? And he would go, yeah, it hurts a lot. He said, you know, in the morning, it's incredibly difficult running the first 20 minutes, the pain. And he said, I just overcame the pain. And he said, the kids that he met in the cancer ward when he was going through treatment back in Vancouver initially, when he was 17 and 18 years old, it really, really affected him watching these youngsters younger than him fight cancer and in many cases not winning and passing away. And it deeply, deeply affected him. And he would say, I can stop running anytime I want. I can quit tomorrow if I want to. But people with cancer and those kids in that cancer ward, they can't stop fighting. So I'm not going to stop running. And he used that experience of his in the hospital to motivate him. And in the book, there were two nurses, one of them who, and they were both friends and still are, and they're up in their 80s, but one was the nurse who took care of him when his leg was first amputated. And she was the one who said to them, you can let this ruin your life, or you can make something out of it, and you can go out there and do something. And then the other nurse was the one who took care of him when he came home after he got sick, and was the spokesperson for the family for the next year. And both of them are very close to the family, but the second one, Allison Ince, gave me a letter, because I met with them several times when I was writing the book. Just give me insights to who Terry was. And the nurse that took care of him gave me a letter that Terry sent to her in January of 1980. It's a two-page letter, and it's absolutely amazing. And it's in the book, word for word. And he talks about, here's what I'm going, I'm so excited. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to run across Canada. And he thanks her for being the motivator to get that dream, to follow his dream, to work at it. By the way, he ran 3,000 miles before he started running, just learning how to run. And that letter is just so moving. And when you read it in Terry's words, saying, I'm going to run across Canada, and here's why I'm going to run across Canada. And both of those people, Allison Ince and Judith Ray, were just phenomenal. I can't thank them enough for the help that they gave me. Judith lives in Mission, and Allison lives in Surrey.
July 11th, 1980, Terry Fox ran to Toronto City Hall. Toronto Maple Leaf great Darrell Sittler was there to greet him with thousands of fans. I asked Bill Vigors if that was the day that Terry and the team knew the country was now paying attention.
I think Toronto was the apex, but it actually started, first off, when he crossed the border into Ontario. It went from day and night. He comes across the bridge at Porcs Hawkesbury, and there's a high school band playing. I'll still never forget why they picked that tune, but they're playing Georgie Girl. And to this day, I always smile as he's coming across the bridge, and there, if you know the song, hey there, Georgie Girl. And then when he did the kickoff of the football at the Ottawa game, and we were downstairs underneath the stands, and I think the field is still the same. And all that was, it was a hockey arena under there. And only the exit lights lit the place, and Terry's trying to kick at the ball, and he's afraid he's going to shank it or fall down. And they call him out onto the field, and I'm thinking to myself, I hope they know who he is. And he didn't even get to the sidelines when the announcer was, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome. And the place went crazy for about 5 minutes, a standing ovation. And then at center field, Jerry Organ and the football players, or Tony Gabriel, are talking to him and saying, you know, as professional athletes, they would never be able to do this. And then slowly, between Ottawa and Toronto, there's a whole bunch of little towns. Probably the biggest one was 1,500 people. And every town you'd go to, there'd be 2,000 people. They all came in from the cottages. It was summertime. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we did the Scarborough Civic Center, which I almost canceled. Thank goodness I didn't. And then we come down University Avenue. And I had met with a group of people right after I met Terry in New Brunswick. And a radio station, a guy by the name of Jeremy Brown, and some, you know, pretty successful businessmen in Toronto. And all I had was a couple of Polaroids to show them that I had taken a picture of Terry out east, and told them that, you know, he was coming. And I didn't realize I was doing the biggest sales job of my life. But at the end of the meeting, they said, don't worry about Toronto. You take care of the rest of the province. So until we ran down University Ave, and it was lined 5-6 people deep on either side, people in the office buildings, in the doorways. And we're passing all of the hospitals that now do research funded by Terry. And if you know Toronto, there's a main intersection, University Ave and Queen Street, and you make a left-hand turn heading east. And literally, as you go around the corner, is Nathan Phillips Square, Toronto City Hall. And it is packed from the stage, a block in every direction. And the roar of the people when Terry came, and it's echoing off of the skyscrapers. It's a sound I'll never forget. And We're trying to make our way through the crowd to get him up to the stage. And he gets up in the stage, and I can remember standing and staring up at this man. His name was Jeremy Brown. He was a radio station announcer in Toronto. He was the guy that said, leave it to us, we'll make it happen. And I can remember standing at staring, because I was down in the crowd. I didn't ever go up on stage. And I'm looking up and I'm going, Jeremy, you pulled it off. You really did. And I think that's when I knew. I think Terry, all of us knew. You could, when you see Terry at Toronto City Hall and the smile on his face, the two things you notice. One, he knows his message has gotten out. Number two, there's a scene where his dad takes his arm and holds it up sort of like as a champion, and Terry immediately pulls it down. And he did not like being called a hero. He did not like that reference. As a matter of fact, when he got sick in Thunder Bay, he was concerned that people had put him up on a pedestal and maybe lost sight of why he was doing the run.
What was the biggest logistical nightmare of the run?
Believe it or not, the biggest logistical nightmare of the run was some individuals within the Canadian Cancer Society who were supposed to be following a schedule and weren't, and made him run out of his way, made him, in one instance, do two events that were 30 miles apart. He got no dinner that night. That incident caused great friction between Terry and I. As a matter of fact, they had come up and said, if he doesn't go to the second event, you're going to be off the run and we're probably going to fire you. And to which I had to tell Terry what the situation was. He threw a sandwich at me. I brought his clubhouse sandwich and his fries in, and I was apologetic. I should have been. I blame myself because I should have been on top of it. I should have known that we had already dealt with this gentleman once before, that he might pull something like this. Nonetheless, we didn't speak for a couple of days. When we did make up, there was a point where inside my head and my heart, although I'd only been working for the Cancer Society for less than 6 months, 4 months, and at that time I really needed the job. I really needed the job. But there came a point during the run, and I decided I'm working for Terry. I'm not working for the Cancer Society anymore. So I began to basically ignore National, because there was a complete disconnect about what was happening on the road and what was happening in downtown Toronto. So they were asking him to do stuff that there's no way he was going to do. And they'd send me the messages to, you know, we'll tell him to do this. I'd go, yeah, okay. I wouldn't tell him. I'd just ignore him. So needless to say, I was not the most popular guy with some individuals at the Cancer Society, although not my bosses. I had two bosses. One was a guy by the name of Harry Rollins, and he was staff. He was the executive director. Very smart man. He was a Bell executive and a good people person. And my other boss was a volunteer, and a guy by the name of Ron Potter from London, Ontario. And he was an insurance executive. And I always referred to him, he was a leader of men. People, he hardly spoke, but when he did, it was always calm and it was always intelligent, and he was always able to sway people. And between those two people, swaying a meeting in Toronto at the last minute, the Cancer Society may not have even been involved with Terry. So the crisis were lack of understanding within the organization itself. And I just got to the point where I just ignored them all the time. I've never been really good at following rules to begin with. Just ask my grade 9, my grade 10, my grade 11 teachers, who all liked me so much they kept me for an extra year.
What were the moments of pure magic that stand out after all these years? Is there one moment that really stands out?
The day with the young amputee up in Terrace, Greg Scott, that Terry had met in Hamilton, and he had the same osteosarcoma that Terry had the other opposite leg amputated. And I was able to arrange to fly him up to run with Terry. And Terry, and once again, that's in the documentary and it's in the book, the story about how Terry, this young boy, inspired Terry. Terry called it the most inspirational 2 days of the entire run. That was a magic moment. The magic moments came, a lot of the time it came not on the road, but after, and particularly during dinner. At the end of the day, and this was usually the routine in Ontario, even the policemen that we may go through two policemen, maybe one policeman all day, but at the end of the day, the policeman would join us, the district director, my kids, Doug and Darryl, and it was always a joyous occasion having dinner. On the odd occasion, Terry was, not feeling good, but I would say 98% of the time, dinner time was always a good time. By the way, we had the odd, maybe it wasn't odd, maybe more than that odd is not food fights in the restaurants. But we had a number one rule. You cannot get food on the restaurant, the table, the floors, or the walls. So my favorite story is, and we're in a Chinese restaurant, and anyway, Daryl reaches over and pulls the front of Terry's shorts open and takes the soy sauce bottle. And like he was splashing vinegar, just for about 15 seconds, just sits there shaking the bottle into Terry's pants. And Terry just sits there with a smile on his face. And he puts it down, and then Terry has a bite. And then Terry reaches over and he picks up a bowl of sweet and sour sauce, opens up Daryl's shorts, and just slowly pours it down the front of his shorts. And it was silliness. It was teenage silliness. And I heartily condoned it.
Rewind to September 1st, 1980. Terry had run 5,573 kilometers over 143 days. But the Marathon of Hope came to an abrupt stop near Thunder Bay, Ontario. Cancer had returned to Terry's lungs. I asked Bill Vigors about being on the inside when that happened and how the team reacted as Canadians responded with support.
I'll address the day itself. It was devastating. It hit all of us like a rock. I think Terry realized that he had a problem long before it came to fruition. But I was actually at my mom and dad's 40th wedding anniversary in St. Thomas. I flew up. I arrived at the same time as mom and dad did from the West Coast. We went to the hospital, went into his hospital room. Terry himself broke the news that the cancer was back. And then we were told that he had to fly home immediately because one of his lungs was filling with fluid. And if he didn't fly out laying down, all the way to Vancouver, he'd be stuck in Thunder Bay for a week. So I went into all my emotions shut down, and I just became, let's get this done. And we immediately flew out, Doug and Daryl, and I should have let them stay around and empty the van the next day so that they could have some closure. But I was just thinking of getting everybody home. Meanwhile, we're talking to Ontario Health, and we've already tried the Toronto Star and a few corporate, trying to get a private jet to fly him home, and nobody can come through. And this gentleman by the name of Lou Fine, who is a district director from Sudbury North, a man who does not mince words, he's got OHIP on the line, and he says, we need a plane to fly Terry Fox home. And they go, well, who's going to pay for it? And then Lou said, you are. Well, we can't do that. And it went up the chain, and finally he says to the last person, who is still saying, we can't do that, I've got all of the media of Canada standing outside my door. Do you want me to walk out there right now and tell them that you won't fly Terry Fox home? One moment, sir. And 30 seconds, they're back on the line, and there'll be a plane there in an hour and a half. The hard part was the ride to the airport. Terry gave that speech, and then I got into the ambulance with mom and dad, the doctor, and Christy Blatchford, who was a reporter from the Toronto Star, who had become very close with Terry. And as we're riding out to the airport, his dad's going, this isn't fair. This is not fair. And Terry goes, why, Dad? And he said, the cancer. And he said, Dad, I'm no different than anybody else. He said, this is what cancer is all about. Maybe now people will understand why I was doing it. Because he knew people were going to watch him go through that treatment. And I was lucky enough to be flown out by CTV for the telethon. And the first night I slept in his room because he was in the hospital and the room was piled high with boxes of all the things that people had given to him along the road. And then that night watching the telethon where they raised, I think they hit over $10 million. And I watched most of it with Terry and Doug and Daryl. And then Doug and Daryl, his brother and his best friend, they go downstairs because they want them to do some media. And they roll in the bag and they start the drip for chemotherapy with Terry, and he fell asleep on my shoulder. And I worked for the Cancer Society, but I didn't know what cancer was. I had never had anybody go through it. And I, like the rest of Canada, spent the next 8 or 9 months on that journey with Terry, to which he said, "I'm not disappointed. I did the best I possibly could. I couldn't have done any better. And maybe the run will continue." And by the way, right after he got sick, Isidore Sharp, who was the president of Four Seasons, who was a big supporter, sent Terry a telegram. Back those days, you sent telegrams. And Izzy said, "I'm going to organize an annual run in your name on the third Sunday of September every year." And this year, 43 years later, please, folks, if you're listening, read the book, get inspired again, find Terry's hope and his legacy, and get out and keep the fight against cancer going.
That was my interview from 2023 with the late Bill Viggers, author of Terry and Me.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In focus, Taiwan.tw. Taiwan signs MOU on drone cooperation with Poland, Ukraine. At the International Defense Industry Exhibition in Poland, an agreement with Ukrainian and Polish counterparts to build cooperation in the field of unmanned aerial vehicle technology. Taiwan will provide technology and components, while Ukraine will contribute research and development, and Poland will share its expertise in the field. Meanwhile, Taiwan's ruling Democratic Progressive Party called military parades held earlier this year in Moscow and last week in Beijing threats to world peace. Xi Jinping hosted Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un at a September 3rd parade to mark 80 years since the end of World War II and the Second Sino-Japanese War. The head of the DPP's Department on China Affairs, Wu Junji, said the lesson of World War II was to, quote, "oppose aggression and pursue peace," end quote. In ABC News Australia, anti-establishment protest on Sydney Harbour Bridge creates new dilemma for police. A demonstration organized by an umbrella group, Australia Unites Against Government Corruption, is being planned for the Sydney Harbour Bridge on September 13th. In budget estimates, senior police said they had been notified, but officers provided no details about planned route, duration, or potential impact on traffic. After trying and failing to stop August's pro-Palestinian demonstration on the bridge, police could face the prospect of another Supreme Court showdown. In Hong Kong Free Press, driven out, why the owner of the US 8964 license plate faced police scrutiny and a year of harassment. Anthony Chu's Porsche with the plate US 8964, an apparent reference to the Tiananmen crackdown anniversary, had been in the crosshairs of the Hong Kong authorities since 2022. The vehicle was eventually sent abroad after Chu faced a year of harassment. Chu has moved with his family to the United Kingdom. The number 8964 refers to the June 4, 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, died when Chinese soldiers cracked down on student-led protests for democracy. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, West Coast governors say states will establish their own vaccine guidelines. Three Democratic governors, Oregon's Tina Kotek, Washington's Bob Ferguson, and California's Gavin Newsom, said their states formed a West Coast Health Alliance to ensure residents remain protected by science, not politics, in response to what they called the Trump administration's dismantling of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's credibility and independence. Last week, federal regulators cleared updated COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer, Moderna, and Novavax that target newer variants of the virus. But, unlike in previous years, the approval leaves many without clear access to the vaccine. In Crosscut, Okanagan County protests highlight rural impact of Trump policies. Organizers in the North Central Washington Republican stronghold want to call attention to how recent cuts could hurt the region's poorest residents. Okanagan County, which borders British Columbia, is the state's largest county by area. At more than 5,300 square miles, it's nearly equal to the state of Connecticut. By population, the county had nearly 45,000 residents based on a 2024 estimate by the U.S. Census Bureau. It's smaller than a few dozen Washington cities. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. BC Ferries refuses to release contract with Chinese state-owned shipyard. And confusion on the first day of the BC government workers' strike. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people who organize events that merge fitness and charity, such as the Parkinson Super Walk, Kickin' Pancreas, and of course the Terry Fox Run. They're great for communities, they're great for fitness, and they're great to help raise money to overcome suffering. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 7th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 7th of September in 2012, citing human rights, the Canadian government closed the embassy in Tehran and cut diplomatic ties with Iran. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.